As entrepreneurs, we're hearing all kinds of messaging on how we have to build deep relationships with our clients. We're hearing we've got to use big data. What is big data? How do you build these relationships? How do you create really powerful long-term relationships so that we recognize a lifetime client value? I mean, this is stuff that all of us are hearing about. And I got to tell you, it's unbelievably valuable when you do it. We are doing it. We're just learning it. And over the last few years, it's been huge impact on our businesses. And I want it to be on yours. And one of the top individuals in this whole arena is our special guest, Peter Fader. Peter is one of the top fellow entrepreneurs, but he's also a professor of marketing. So he's one of those data geeks, number guys that actually likes creating results from a marketing perspective. And he's one of the co-directors. I'm looking over to the side to make sure I get the right title of Wharton Customer Analytics Initiative. So stay tuned. If you've ever wondered if you're using data right, you're building those right relationships to create tremendous value for your clients and for yourselves, stay tuned.
You want amazing, remarkable, exceptional breakthroughs. Dig deep, think bold, drive hard. Watch yourself soar beyond your dreams. AESNation.com.
Peter, I am so excited to have you join us. I mean, I've had the privilege of working with you a little bit. I'm going to have you come out and visit with my 200-plus financial advisor mastermind group because I think your message, your book, all the research you're doing is so powerful. So I want to share you with our group here at AES Nation. So thank you, Peter, for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, John, and glad to have a chance to share the message with everyone who follows you.
Tell me a little bit how you got to where you are. I want to get a little of the backstory so they get some framing.
Unlike most of the folks you talk to who have just an incredible autobiography, I've been sitting in this same chair for 28 years doing pretty much the same thing. It's just that the world has changed in a way to make my work all of a sudden interesting. So the fact is, I'm a number cruncher. I like looking for patterns in data. I like predicting things, but I like to do it from a practical perspective, which means I want to use math that's easily accessible to most people, like Excel, and I want to be able to answer real problems, not just nice theoretical ones. So whether it's been, I don't know, sports statistics or looking at or playing dollar bill poker and looking for patterns and numbers there, or in particular, if we're looking at customer data to try to understand who are the right kinds of customers, who we should invest in, what we should expect out of them, those kinds of questions. That's what I've been doing for three decades. But all of a sudden, companies and entrepreneurs in particular really care about that stuff in a way that they never did before.
How are you seeing entrepreneurs start putting it into place, and what are they doing with it to get, you know, start moving along on this journey?
So a lot of what I do, here's the secret, is to take the kinds of things that direct marketers were doing to sell Ginsu knives on late night TV back in the 60s and 70s, and just take some of those very basic perspectives, frameworks, methods, and just update them to, you know, 50 years later. So a lot of it is kind of tried and true things that our forefathers in direct marketing and other fields have done. It's just bringing it to new fields, to new data structures, to new kinds of managerial decisions. But it's distinctly not magic. And unfortunately, a lot of firms see it that way, that it's magical or that it's some kind of black box that they can't understand. I think it's really important for people to have at least some appreciation for the math, but we're not here to talk about the math per se, but to understand how it's going to change the kinds of decisions that you'd be making if you didn't have access to that kind of data and models.
Over the last several years, I've gotten really interested in the direct marketing community and the Ginsu knives and the late night infomercials, and they were one of the first to really collect data, but it was very hard to collect that data.
Too many people, too many companies are out there saying, oh, it's a whole new world. The old rules don't apply. It seems like every 10 years there's some kind of, you know, generational wave that we got to throw out the old and start with the new. And while that might be true with specifically the kinds of data that we have or the words that we put around it, the basic patterns of how people behave, you know, how many of them are going to come in and try something, how many of them are going to try it a second time or become loyal to it, those basic patterns are remarkably robust. They're incredibly stable over time, across geographies and across industries. So the real key here is to be open to learning from some of these other domains instead of saying, oh, ours is different or, oh, today is different. So if we can just take the greatest hits from these other sectors or other time periods, there's a lot of collected wisdom already, so we don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Well, and one of the things, Peter, we talked before in a previous conversation, I want to introduce you to Joe Polish, who is one of those old, I mean, he's not an old guy, but an old-time direct marketer. He's learned with some of the greatest guys like Dan Kennedy and others. And Joe, I'm part of his mastermind group. It's called Genius Network Mastermind. And one of the reasons I joined was I saw the power of living in Silicon Valley, of using big data. But you've got to use the tools of the old way of doing it. It just now makes it easier to do. And really, that is, to me, revolutionized marketing, you know, and building relationships and the value that can be created. Because it's not only, you know, influence is influence, but it's also that we can now get much deeper in the client and actually serve them better.
That's exactly right. So, you know, while it does indeed revolutionize a lot of firms, there's a lot who have been doing this kind of thing. They recognize if you have a small number of clients, you have a pretty good sense about what they're likely to do and how they'll respond and whose call you're going to take at 2 o'clock in the morning and who's going to have to wait until Monday to get the call back. So there's been a lot of heuristic understanding of this kind of customer centricity, again, especially if you have a relatively small number of customers. The revolutionary thing is to be able to take that understanding and figure out how to use data and technology to be able to scale it up, to be able to do that when you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of customers, to be able to use more technological solutions to be able to do the same kind of thing that you used to be able to do with small numbers. So some of the basic ideas of what we're trying to do aren't new. It's just that people don't think about that it's possible to do on that kind of scale.
I'm so excited about this stuff because it, quite honestly, is fairly new to me. Even though I grew up in the financial services industry, I worked with some of the largest companies and still do. They're doing it, but it's very isolated, and it's not, you know, I think you and I would agree there's a lot of opportunity to do it more. Who's been doing it for a while that our fellow entrepreneurs would know about and doing it well?
So I think that the classic textbook example would be Caesars Entertainment. So when they were in their previous incarnation as Harrah's, it was very interesting that out of desperation, when Harrah's couldn't compete on an equal level with a lot of its deeper pocketed competitors, they said, you know what, we got to do something that's different from the others. Let's turn to the data and let's build the loyalty program and let's get these deep insights and let's have the courage to be able to treat different customers differently on the basis of what we think they're going to be worth to us. Let's align them based on their value and then allocate accordingly instead of trying to roll out the red carpet to absolutely everybody because we can't tell the difference among them. So Harrah's rose to the top of their industry, ended up buying Caesars Entertainment. So that's one classic textbook story. And there's a number of other companies like that, Tesco, the grocery retailer in the UK, and then, of course, a lot of e-commerce startups. One could argue that this is the whole basis of Amazon, for instance. So Jeff Bezos wasn't out there to sell books. He was out there and has been quoted as saying this, using books just as a way to find people with a lot of disposable income and then sell them all kinds of stuff. That's what I'm talking about. And while some companies are kind of born into it, they're born around the technology, it's much tougher for older, more established companies or older, more established industries to do this kind of pivot and to start saying, you know what, we now can treat our customers differently in a way that just wasn't possible before. And you know what, we might be able to make more money by being able to sort those customers out and figure out who the more valuable ones and so on, rather than just trying to sell the same thing to as many people as possible.
Yeah. Honestly, I became interested in this in the 2008-2009 downturn in the financial markets, because our consulting, our coaching was to the big firms, and all of a sudden the big firms, you know, some weren't there, and then others weren't, in our case, were helping the top financial advisors with wealth management build great practices to serve their clients. Well, we've got a segment that's not for everybody. We've got to work with them. And now we no longer had the firm's ability to do that. So we had to market direct. And that's where I really became interested in this whole data, because the data is available. It's easy to sort through with today's technology. And one of the biggest mistakes I think all of us make, we used to shoot out this wide net to everyone and treat everyone equal. And boy, they're not equal. You know, one of the things you write about in your book a lot is this client lifetime value. Let's define that and tie that into that segmentation, you know, why it's so valuable.
Oh, I'm happy to do so, because that is really the heart and soul of all this stuff. So we're looking at a particular customer, and I'm completely agnostic as to what we mean by customer. So it could be a client in a financial services setting. It could be someone buying tickets to sporting events, but it also could be on a B2B side. So it could be a business that you see as the client or the mm-hmm. customer. And what we want to do is to project how much revenue, how much profit we're going to get from that client in the future. And let's project it not just over the next quarter or the next year, but let's project it out as far as we can imagine, 10, 20 years, maybe further. Of course, recognizing the time value of money, that those dollars we get 20 years from now aren't as worth as much to us as the dollars we get tomorrow. And so let's come up with really, really accurate projections about what those cash flows might look like. And let's use that as our basis to decide who the best clients are, as opposed to historical profitability. Let's judge people on what we think they're going to be worth to us, as opposed to what they have been worth to us. Now, admittedly, those two are close to each other. If someone's been a good client in the past, they're probably going to be decent in the future. But it's not a one-to-one mapping. And if you're going to want to play this game the right way, you care more about the future than the past.
I'm a little embarrassed, Peter. It's so blindingly simple that, you know, so many of us as entrepreneurs have been slow to do it. We've been slugging it out the hard way, you know, just one client at a time, one relationship, one B2B type. And then now I feel like I'm a kid in a candy store with all this data. I now can go, okay, this is who we want to talk with.
So let me put it in perspective specifically for entrepreneurs. So because a lot of these ideas we often associate with bigger companies that have the big elaborate CRM systems and the millions of customers to pick and choose. So how does it all fit for entrepreneurs? So the thing is, most entrepreneurs, for good reason, are inherently product centric. You know, they've come up with that great idea, a product or a service, and it's all hands on deck to figure out how to refine that product, how to get the message out, and how to get as many people as possible to buy it. That's the definition of product centricity. And that's totally understandable, because again, you're always going to start a business, or in most cases, with the product or the service. The issue is this: as you grow and then you have more and more customers and you start adding more products to the line and so on, at some point you're going to stagnate. At some point competition is going to catch up. At some point you're going to have to say, you know what, it's not enough just to tweak this product-centric business model. We need something different. And it might be because of competition, as in the case of Harris, or a variety of other reasons. And at that point, people start picking up my book or other books on this basic topic and saying, we got to learn this customer centricity stuff. We got to learn how to value those customers and build our business around them. What I want for entrepreneurs is to recognize that while they're not going to be customer-centric right out of the gate, and that's understandable, that pivot is going to take place. And I'm not saying they necessarily have to do it sooner rather than later, but I want them to be building, to sowing the seeds, building the infrastructure, having the mindset and the culture, so when the time is right, it's as simple as kind of flipping a switch and saying, you know, we can use this other strategy now, or maybe we can use both strategies for different parts of the business. So it's just a recognition that for so many companies, building the business around the customer often becomes vital for the future. So let's figure it out, even when we're in a mode where we're not going to be necessarily doing that stuff on a day-to-day basis.
When do you think this big breakthrough happened? You know, I mean, my guess is a teenager, you didn't think about big data and big companies and client lifetime value. When did this happen? How did it come that you go, geez, this is just amazing?
I remember it so well. It was actually in 1998 was my moment of epiphany, because I was born and raised on packaged goods data. So working with a lot of the CPG firms and then the data suppliers, the Nielsen's and the IRIs, and helping them to build models and so on. But when that whole .com thing started, just out of curiosity, back in 98, mm-hmm. I took a model that I was using actually for a kid's juice drink. And just for fun, I applied it to a .com business just to see how the patterns would be different. You know that they had to be different. People buying music online is going to be very different than people buying kids' juice drinks in a grocery store. Well, it turned out that the patterns were identical. Again, if you look at the number of people who adopt a product over time, or the percent who come back and buy again, and how often they do that, and just what the overall sales curves look like, it's remarkable how similar they were. So this was a moment of epiphany that to be able to kind of break down the walls that to say, oh, here is consumer packaged goods, and oh, here is online electronic commerce. And that made me curious to start to push the boundaries a little bit further. Like, can we dip our toes into financial services? Or what about pharmaceuticals? Or what about media and entertainment? And I haven't found the limits yet. I found, as I mentioned before, that the patterns are remarkably the same. Online, offline, U.S., China, big business, small business, B2B, B2C. Yet I find it just disheartening that so few companies are aware of these patterns and are willing or able to build business models that fully exploit them. That's why I wrote the book.
Whether you're B2B or B2C, you're working with people. And, you know, while we're all different, we're all a little weird, there's so many similarities of how we're influenced and the relationships we want to have with the people who are working with us, serving us, and so on.
Which is to say, in any one sector, with any one business, the customers are actually vastly different from each other. There's going to be the good customers, the not so good customers. The similarity that you're referring to is that range of customers is pretty similar from one industry to another. So the customers aren't similar, but the differences among the customers are similar.
Well, the behavioral issues that we have as individuals, whether I'm representing a big defense, you know, contract, or I'm buying a drink at Starbucks, we're still people, but you know, definitely very different.
That's right. And that's why it bothers me when I see a lot of companies segmenting on the basis of demographics, saying men do this, women do that, Gen Xers do this, Gen Yers do that. The thing is, in any one of those demographic groups, there's still going to be a vast array of differences. And so, yeah, it might be true that the average woman buys a little bit more than the average man, but the spread around that is huge. So when it comes to segmenting customers, we want to do it on the basis of behavior, because that's ultimately what we care most about. In the old days, we couldn't segment on behavior. We couldn't see the behavior at a granular level. But today, we can see it, yet still so many companies are locked into age and gender and whatever else. It's just not necessary or helpful anymore.
Today, with data, you know, Peter, if you're my client, I have all the data about that relationship. So I'm much more equipped. You know, I can segment it down to that individual, not only demographic, psychographics, but the actions that they're taking. And we couldn't do that in the past, you know, on any scale. So that to me is one of the big wows.
And the big wow comes back to the words that you said before, competitive advantage. So if we look at all the textbooks that were written in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, competitive advantage always arose through the products. Like, let's find ways that people can't imitate us or people can never catch up to us. It was always about building competitive advantage through product centricity. Like Michael Porter's work was all around that kind of thing. And I'm not saying it's invalid, but today it's just much harder to build those product-based competitive advantages. But when it comes to our customers, when it comes to the data that you just described, no one can ever take that away from us. That will never, ever commoditize. The things that I know about my customers are unique to me. And so I really see that understanding of customers at a granular level as a true source of competitive advantage, not just a way just to sell more stuff, but to figure out who are the best customers and who are the not so good ones, build the business around that.
Yeah, and serve them well. And it's not that we're manipulating clients or anything. It's our ability to serve the right clients that we can do profitably has never been better. And that's why I love this. Peter, I hadn't thought of this until you said it, is I look at all products, and I know the financial services industry well. They're commoditized. I mean, there's no way of really patenting anything. You know, if something comes out, it can be reinvented 6 months later. So the only thing that really is the value is a relationship. But in the past, it was having, you know, the salesperson having that relationship. Well, today, you know, that's still important, but the data is really the king part of this.
I actually think the salesperson is more important than ever. The pointy end of the spear on this stuff is changing the way that we manage and incent our salespeople. Because traditionally, the way most companies do it is sell a lot of stuff. If you can book enough business, you know, this month, then we're going to give you the good parking space or whatever else. What I want to do is to change Salesforce kind of accounting. Instead of how many orders did you book, it's how much did you lift the forward-looking lifetime value. So I want to encourage salespeople not just to, you know, oh, I got to do this before the deadline, but let's think long term. Let's build relationships. Maybe they're not going to buy a lot from us right now, but we're going to open the door to lots of sales that wouldn't have occurred otherwise. And the nice thing about it is that this is what salespeople want. Salespeople don't want to be order takers. They want to build relationships. I mean, that's why God invented golf, after all, is to let people build relationships. So if we can create structures that let us measure the amount of relationship building that has gone on, as measured by customer lifetime value, and then reward salespeople on that basis, I think we can just revolutionize the way firms work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'd love to say I've already done that. I haven't. But what the salespeople initially, when I was putting it in place, they didn't like the idea, just pay us more. And now they love it, because what it does is they recognize that the buying cycles are deeper, in that people are doing more research before they have a conversation. And when they have the conversation, they may not get it unless they've interacted like this. And then when they do have the conversation, they have unbelievable data, so they can have a rich conversation to serve that person. So we've seen, not only are we having better conversations when we talk about the marketing sales transfer, better conversations with the right people who they can serve really well. And that wouldn't have been possible without the data.
That's right. And that right there, that is competitive advantage.
You are a passionate guy. I'm a passionate guy. We both get excited about numbers and data. It's a little weird, but we can impact so many lives. What are you working on now that you're most passionate about, Peter?
A lot of it is this educational idea. So the models themselves to predict CLV and this and that's done. In fact, that's a good part about it. They're done. They're validated. The math parts, sure, I'm still tweaking a little bit. I'm still living the publish or perish professorial life. But I'm spending a lot of my time, and one of the reasons why I'm having this conversation with you, John, is because I want to pay it forward. I want companies to have a real clarity on what this customer centricity stuff is and what it isn't, the value that they can get from it. And one of the things that I've seen is that for companies to get real value from it, it's not just a matter of them doing the number crunching themselves, but if they themselves can pay it forward, if you can teach your clients how they can be customer-centric with their own customers, then it's going to give them a better appreciation of why you're doing it for them. So a lot of it isn't just giving people the math and the methods, which, again, is most of what my life is, but it's trying to find ways to make this stuff just really palatable, to make it just real easy for folks to understand it and share it. And again, that's one of the reasons why, as a real technical guy, I kind of was willing to kind of put down the calculator and write a very non-technical book in the hopes that it's going to spread the gospel in a way that others could continue moving it forward as well.
Peter, one of the things I normally do is I say, you know, what's your favorite book? And I'm not going to let you get off that easy and name someone else. I want you to tell me about your book. And you kind of gave me why you wrote it, but what's in there? What, you know, for entrepreneurs particularly, how do they get the gold out of this?
So it's really three things. Number one, it's just bringing clarity to these two words, customer centricity. Unfortunately, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And for some, it means just being nice to everybody. You know, if any customer has a little hiccup there, well, then we're not doing our job well. I don't believe that. I absolutely believe that there are some customers who are better than others, and we're going to be more responsive to them. And again, I look often at financial services as an area that's been willing to do that and has been rewarded as a result. And I want to see other industries take on those same kinds of practices. So that's number one. It's just bringing clarity to the basic definition. Point number two, as I alluded to before, is understanding this healthy balance between being product-centric and being customer-centric. For some firms, it means making a choice. We can only be one or the other. We can only have one strategy. We can only be thinking in one direction or hiring people with one kind of talent. For other companies, it means finding ways for those two to coexist with each other, that we're going to be really customer-centric with those customers who are really valuable. And for those other customers, we're going to just do them in great volume. That's going to be more product-centric. And third, as I mentioned briefly before, it's understanding the evolution that some firms go to from being product-centric towards customer-centric, and just what are the things you need to do, what are the metrics you need to start bringing in place, just how do you start changing the culture of the organization to move in that kind of direction. So I want to bring clarity and then offer some just initial advice. I'll be the first to admit it's not the end-all and be-all, just to get people to think about some of those differences, those dualities, and that evolution from one kind of thinking to the other.
And it doesn't stop there, Peter. I know on your website at the school, you've got other resources. What might entrepreneurs find there?
So a lot of it is the idea of harnessing that data. So when I'm talking to entrepreneurs, I'm always asking them three questions. So if you had to kind of rank, if you had to choose the best bits of behavioral data that you have about your clients, what would it be? In other words, what data are you most interested in tracking and databasing and so on? That's number one. Number two, what derived measures would you create out of that observed data? And then number three, how is that going to change the way you make your decisions? Now, the right answer to question number two is going to be lifetime value. So we're going to look at the different behavioral data that we have, and then we're going to come up with these forward-looking projections and eventually use that to target customers, change the way we do the business, everything that we've covered. I want entrepreneurs to be really thoughtful about that. I want entrepreneurs to realize that maybe not tomorrow, but a year or two or five from now, we're going to be building our business around that stuff. So we might as well start figuring it out now. We might as well appreciate a little bit of the math. Or at least the behavioral data that we need to have in place, as well as some of the systems, some of the early things that we'll do towards building a proper CRM system. Maybe starting with a simple loyalty program or other tactics like that. And so a lot of the research that I've done and a lot of the technical notes that I've written and a lot of the workshops that I run, all of these things are alluded to on my website, are just holding people's hands, giving them both the motivation to want to go in this direction, as well as some of the actual tools to help them take some of those first steps.
You make it a lot easier, Peter, and that's so invaluable. Let me play back the key takeaways that, I really heard. I wrote down. I mean, number one, I'm going to go competitive advantage, strategic advantage. We worked so hard to get this. And that shift from product to client or customer is huge. The products are commoditized. And if your industry isn't, it's weird that it's not yet, but it will be. And this is the only way that we can really differentiate ourselves. And boy, get started now. I mean, as a fellow entrepreneur, I want you to have a big win. Peter wants you to have a big win. Everybody at AES Nation wants that. Second is the recognition. And this is one that's so easy for us to screw up, is some clients are better than others. Some customers are better than others. And we should treat them that way as well as seek them. And then third, using this data to really mine for lifetime value is just such a big deal. And this has been amazing. So thank you for sharing your insights.
It is my pleasure, John. I want to give you credit, A+ to you for pulling those three takeaways, because there's a lot of different messages in the stuff that I'm writing about and doing in my research. And sometimes people pick up on some of the less impactful parts, but you hit the nail on the head, and I hope that all of your viewers and listeners will do so as well.
your clients, your customers, and all those future client and customers. They're counting on you to do this well. Don't let them down. We wish you the best of success.
Exceptional, remarkable breakthrough. AESNation.com.